Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week, Lama Kathy Wesley gives a talk entitled The Gentle Power of Love, Part 2. Mindfulness helps us see our inner thoughts, feelings, and motivations in ways that were not possible before we practiced meditation. But how do we deal with the disappointment of being imperfect in an imperfect world? By practicing love for ourselves, looking at ourselves with the eyes of love of a devoted grandparent or an enlightened master. This talk presents strategies for developing love for ourselves and all the children of the world. This series is based on Kempo Carter Rinpoche's teachings on the Dedication and Aspiration chapter of Shantideva's The Way of the Bodhisattva. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
So good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. It's delightful to be here with you. Kempo Carter Rinpoche always said that the prayer that helped him a lot when things go wrong is the Tashi prayer, because it's calling on the presence of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and asking them to benefit beings. And one time I was traveling to India, and my friends and I said, well, you know, we might encounter difficulties along the way. What should we do? And he said, well, whenever you encounter a difficulty, just start reciting the Tashi prayer. And so we ended up doing that quite a bit. Tire went flat, Tashi prayer. Suddenly in the middle of a traffic stop at a checkpoint, the battery dies, Tashi prayer. You know, so can't find a restroom in rural India in the middle of the night, Tashi prayer. But it worked every time. We were able to surmount our obstacles, not necessarily immediately, but at least we had a good attitude as we were attempting to remedy what was going on. And so I guess that's a good way to start the Dharma talk today. To talk about the fact that our practice of meditation and our Dharma practice is in some ways for us a remedy for the angst and concerns of everyday life. For many of us, we started meditating because we needed to have some quiet in our lives, and we needed to have a different way. We needed to take ourselves out of our everyday reality, which sometimes causes us to be overstimulated and sometimes causes our minds to be overstimulated. So if we consciously and physically take ourselves out of that everyday environment and place ourselves on a meditation seat, we may not be going to a distant, serene retreat place somewhere, but what we're doing is we're giving ourselves a moment to experience the natural inner quiet of our minds. And so that's why many of us started to practice meditation. That and all of our friends said, you know, you really should meditate. So now we find ourselves having meditated for a while and being ready to move on to the next phase of our spiritual life, because meditation, as good as it is only a foundation. It's a foundation that helps us to understand ourselves better. And mindfulness, the mindfulness meditation, helps us to see our reactions to things in real time, how our minds can be overwhelmed by its own prejudices, how our minds can be overwhelmed by its own difficulties and its own suffering, and how we can then, sometimes being overwhelmed, we can act out against ourselves or act out against others. And we can begin, through mindfulness, to form the wish to practice some kind of restraint. And so for many people, meditation gives them a view into their minds and their thinking processes in real time, which I think is incredibly valuable. We need that. This is why we go to friends and ask friends advice about things we're doing. We say, you know, hey, here's my experience of this thing. Will you, friend, be my reality check? And then the reality check sometimes comes to us as in ways we're not ready for. Like when a friend starts a sentence with, you know what your problem is. You know, it's not the kind of feedback necessarily that you're looking for, but you will get it from time to time. But when we self-reflect, our lives have more value. When we self-reflect, our lives can be evolutionary. When we self-reflect, even though it's hard sometimes to see who we are and where we've been, we actually have the potential to take that and move forward from it instead of just being where we are and feeling unhappy. So that's the function of all Dharma practice. There are the theories of Dharma, and there are many theories and philosophies of Dharma. You can endlessly study them. In his book, Dharma Paths, Kenpo Karta Rinpoche, in his chapter on wisdom, says there is a difference between knowledge and wisdom. You can study all the books, know all of the theories of Buddhism by heart, but still have no practice. And therefore, even all those theories and philosophies just become another credential that you use to try to impress other people with how great you are. Whereas knowledge, he says, you'll never get to the end of the objects of knowledge. You'll never get to the end of it if you study. You may never practice. But if you practice meditation and learn knowledge for how that knowledge helps you practice better, if you see what I mean, if you actually use your knowledge and the objects that you learn about to inspire you to practice more, he said, then wisdom will come from that. So hopefully that's what we're going to do in this Dharma Talk series that we're doing. The Dharma Talk series is called The Gentle Power of Love, and this is the second in the series. And they're loosely based on Kenpo Karta Rinpoche's teachings that he gave a few weeks ago at Karma Triana Dharma Chakra Monastery on loving kindness and compassion. Kenpo Rinpoche decided to base his remarks on a text, because he said texts are a good jumping off point. The great texts written by the great masters give us some ideas. And so last time I promised that I would bring back enough copies for everyone, and I think it worked. So I have what I hope are 40 copies of the text that we're going to be working from. And I'm going to ask if I can have a couple people to help, one side, the other side, to help pass these out. I think the thing to do is to start by actually reading this out loud in English, which the listening audience, I will try to, the people who listen to the podcast and to our Dharma Talk podcast, will try and find a place to put this online so that you can read it and join in with us. But we're going to go ahead and read it out loud all together so we can get a little of the inspiration going. This text was written by the great Indian saint Shantideva in the 8th century, the 8th century of our common era. And he gave this final chapter. This is the final chapter of a 10-chapter work where he talks about in the first chapter, he talks about how powerful bodhicitta is, because that's really the central part of my series, of this Dharma Talk series, is on what is bodhicitta and how do we use bodhicitta to transform ourselves through the gentle power of love and compassion. And so bodhi means awakening, citta means mind. And by wishing for the benefit of others and attempting to attain our own liberation from suffering for the benefit of others so that they also can be led to freedom from suffering is talked about in the entirety of the chapters, the 10 chapters. The first chapter, he says, bodhicitta is so powerful, he says that even though this world is, he's in the, I think it's chapter 1, verse 5, he says, like a flash of lightning in the dark of night, momentarily illuminates all that the darkness had hid. Likewise, rarely, through the Buddha's power, thoughts of goodness arise in this world. We all know what that feels like. The second of these verses goes, thus behold the utter frailty of goodness. Except for perfect bodhicitta, there is nothing able to withstand the great and overwhelming force of evil. I've memorized this two sets of verses to help keep me encouraged in the modern world, because the modern world can be so discouraging, and we can think that the bad people are going to win and that the negative forces are just too strong. But the Buddha himself and Shantideva is giving his teaching, says that except for perfect bodhicitta, there is nothing that can withstand the great and overwhelming force of evil. So that means bodhicitta stands against evil and will win. And so that's hopeful for us. That means that as we feel those fleeting thoughts of goodness and encourage them, as we feel those fleeting thoughts of wanting to benefit both ourselves and others and nurture them, we are doing the most that we can to bring light into a darkness, and that actually this light will eventually prevail. And so that's what he says in chapter one. Then the remaining chapters are how to take that flicker of light that is the generation of the bodhisattva attitude to benefit others, how to take that flicker and fan it into a flame, and then how to use that flame to sort of burn away our obstacles and obscurations, and then to eventually reveal our inner wisdom. And so by the time he's gotten to chapter 10, he's feeling really good about bodhicitta and the power of bodhicitta. So he makes the dedication that the nine chapters he's just composed will help liberate even beings in the deepest hell. Some of us know what hell feels like. Some of us have felt the flames from within ourselves, our own anger, our own suffering. Or we have seen those we love suffering through negative things. And wouldn't we love to be able to help them? Well, the bodhisattva motivation doesn't give us the immediate power to bring people out of suffering manually and to rescue them, but it does set up the circumstance for being able to do that someday. And so in this chapter 10, Shantideva imagines a world in which the three great bodhisattvas, Avalokiteshvara, bodhisattva of compassion, also known as Chenrezig, the perfection of love, Manjushri, Manjugosha in this text, the bodhisattva of wisdom, and Vajrapani, the bodhisattva of great power and ability, how the three of them appear in hell and take the beings and basically scoop the beings out of hell and bring them to happiness. And then he makes all kinds of aspirations. So here's the thing. If you're ever feeling discouraged, and if you ever feel like, well, maybe I don't have Buddha nature, or maybe I can't get enlightened, or maybe I'm just too confused, I encourage people to read chapter one of Shantideva out loud as a way of teaching themselves. And then they should also read chapter 10 out loud as a way of encouraging themselves. And I've had several of my Dharma friends tell me, you know, I get so discouraged sometimes, I don't think there's any hope for me. And I say, well, read chapter 10 out loud every day until you feel different. And one of my dear Dharma friends from here at the KTC, he's passed away now, he did that. And he said it really helped him. So even though it's going to be a little bit weird for the people listening on the podcast, I think we're just going to go ahead and recite this in English as best we can. It'll take about 10 minutes, but you will, you know, it's a good 10 minutes. It's okay if you giggle when you hear about hell, because that's our nervous laughter. Okay.
Everyone at once.
Yeah, everyone together. Thank you for asking. Okay. Through the virtue of having composed this work, a guide to the Bodhisattva's way of life. May all living beings come to engage in the Bodhisattva's conduct. May beings everywhere plagued with the sufferings of body and mind obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by the virtue of my merits. For as long as they remain in cyclic existence, may their mundane happiness never decline, and may all of them uninterruptedly receive waves of joy from bodhisattvas. May all embodied creatures who throughout the universe experience hellish realms come to enjoy the bliss of Sukhavati. May those feeble with cold find warmth. May those oppressed with heat be cooled by the boundless waters that pour forth from the great clouds of the Bodhisattva's merits. May the forest of razor-sharp leaves become a beautiful pleasure grove, and may the trees of knives and swords grow into wish-fulfilling trees. And may the regions of hell become places of joy with vast and fragrant lotus pools, beautified with the exquisite calls of wild ducks, geese, and swans. And may the heaps of burning coals change into heaps of jewels. May the burning ground become a polished crystal floor. And may the mountains of the crushing hells become celestial palaces of worship filled with sugatas. May the rains of lava, blazing stones, and weapons from now on become a rain of flowers. And may all battling with weapons from now on be a playful exchange of flowers. By the force of my virtues, may those caught in the fiery torrents of acid, their flesh eaten away, revealing their lily-white bones, obtain the bodies of celestials and dwell with goddesses in gently flowing rivers. Why are the henchmen of Yama, the unbearable buzzards and vultures, afraid? Through whose noble strength is joy brought upon us and darkness dispelled? Looking up, they behold in the firmament the radiant form of Vajrapani. Through the force of their joy, may they be free from evil and find his company. When they see the lava fires of hell extinguished by a rain of falling flowers mixed with scented water, immediately satisfied, they wonder whose work this was. And in this way, may those in hell behold Padmapani. Friends, don't be afraid, but quickly gather here. What need is there to flee when above us is the youthful Manju Gosha to dispel our fears, the tender Bodhisattva who protects all living beings, and through whose might all suffering is removed and the force of joy abounds. Behold him in an enchanting palace, resounding with hymns sung by 1,000 goddesses, with the tiaras of 100 gods being offered to his lotus feet. And may a rain of many flowers falling on his head, the eyes of which are moist with kindness. Upon seeing Manju Gosha in this way, may those in hell cry out with joy. Likewise, having seen, due to the roots of my wholesome, the cool and sweet-smelling rain falling from joy of Samantabhadra and Sarva Nirvana Vishkambini, may all beings in hell be truly happy. May all the animals be free from the fear of being eaten by one another. May the hungry ghosts be as happy as the men of the northern continent. May they be satisfied by a stream of milk pouring from the hand of the noble Lord Avalokiteshvara, and by bathing in it, may they always be cooled. May the blind see forms, may the deaf hear sounds, and just as it was with Maya Devi, may pregnant women give birth without any pain. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food, may the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find new hope, constant happiness, and prosperity. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their illness, and may every disease in the world never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting one another. May all travelers find happiness everywhere they go, and without any effort, may they accomplish whatever they set out to do. May those who sail in ships and boats obtain whatever they wish for, and having safely returned to the shore, may they joyfully reunite with their relatives. May troubled wanderers who have lost their way meet with fellow travelers, and without any fear of thieves and tigers, may their way be easy without any fatigue. May those who find themselves in trackless, fearless wildernesses, the children, the aged, the unprotected, those stupefied and the insane, be guarded by beneficent celestials. May beings be free from all states of no leisure and be endowed with faith, wisdom, and kindness, with food obtained in a proper manner and excellent conduct. May they be mindful throughout their lives. May all beings be without want for wealth, just like the treasury of space, and without it being the source of dispute or harm. May they always enjoy it as they wish.
May those who have little
be endowed with majesty, and may those whose bodies are worn with toil find magnificent and noble forms. May all lower life forms in the universe take rebirth in higher forms. May the lowly obtain grandeur, and may the proud be humbled. By the merits I have accumulated, may every single being abandon all forms of evil and perpetually engage in virtue. May they never be parted from the awakening mind. May they always engage in the bodhisattva's conducts. May they be cared for by the Buddhas and relinquish the actions of devils. May sentient beings have lives inconceivably long when in fortunate realms. May they always live in contentment, unfamiliar with even the word death. May there abound in all directions gardens of wish-fulfilling trees, filled with the sweet sound of Dharma proclaimed by the Buddha and their sons. And may everywhere be pure and devoid of any rocks, level like the palm of the hand, and the nature of lapis lazuli. And for all the circles of disciples, may many bodhisattvas dwell in every land, abandoning them with their excellent manifestations. May all embodied creatures uninterruptedly hear the sound of Dharma issuing from birds and trees, beams of light, and even space itself. May they always meet with Buddhas and their sons, the Bodhisattvas. Then may these spiritual masters of the world be worshipped with endless clouds of offerings. May celestials bring timely rains so that harvests may be bountiful. May kings act in accordance with Dharma, and the people of the world always prosper. May all medicines be effective, and the repeating of mantras successful. May dakinis, cannibals, and the like be endowed with compassionate minds. May no living creature ever suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled, or their minds ever be depressed. In all temples and monasteries, may reading and recitation flourish and remain. May the Sangha always be in harmony, and may their purposes be accomplished. May monks desiring to practice find quiet and solitary places, and through having abandoned all wandering thoughts, may they meditate with flexible minds. May nuns be materially sufficient, abandon quarreling with each other, and be unharmed. Similarly, may all ordained ones never let their morality weaken. Having repented any moral falls, may evil always be eradicated, and thereby obtaining a happy state of birth, may spiritual conduct not decline even there. May the wise be honored. May they receive alms. May their minds be completely pure, and may they be renowned in all directions. May beings not experience the misery of lower realms, and may they never know any hardships. With a physical form superior to the gods, may they swiftly attain Buddhahood. May sentient beings again and again make offerings to all the Buddhas, and may they constantly be joyful with the inconceivable bliss of the Buddhas. Just as they have intended, may the bodhisattvas fill the welfare of the world, and may all sentient beings receive whatever the Buddhas have intended for them. Similarly, may the Pratyeka Buddhas and Shravakas find happiness, and until I reach the level of the Joyous One, through the kindness of Manjugosha, may I be mindful throughout my lives and always obtain ordination. May I live and be sustained by simple common foods, and in all my lives may I find the ideal solitude for practicing Dharma. Whenever I wish to see something or even wish to ask the slightest question, may I behold without any hindrance the Lord Manjugosha himself. In order to fulfill the needs of beings who reach into the ends of space, may my way of life be just like that of Manjugosha. For as long as space remains, and for as long as living beings remain, until then may I too abide to dispel the misery of the world. May all the pains of living creatures ripen solely upon myself. And through the might of the Bodhisattva Sangha, may all beings experience happiness. May the teachings, which are the sole medicine for suffering and the origin of every joy, be materially supported and honored and abide for a very long time. I prostrate to Manjugosha, through whose kindness wholesome minds ensue, and I prostrate to my spiritual masters, through whose kindness I develop. Okay, thank you. I felt the positive, that there was a positive force of goodness from reciting it, even though we have not received the teaching on it. It's sort of I'll say that reciting it like this is sort of an object of hope, because when we read texts like this, we feel a mixture of things. We feel confusion because we may not understand everything that's in the text. We may actually even feel a little hostility because what we're reading doesn't accord with what we feel and believe. We may say, I don't get that. Or we may say, I don't know, I get it, but I don't know if I believe that. And all of these thoughts and feelings sort of roil up when we read these texts. So I think that by asking everyone to read it out loud today, I wanted to start a, I guess you could say, eventually what will be a conversation about the meaning of these words and about how they can relate to us in the lives that we have now. Because the lives that we have now, even though we are living in the 21st century as opposed to the 8th century when they were written, we have different things that concern us. We have different visions of hell and redemption. We have different visions of goodness and badness. There's still the idea, though, that the Buddha's teaching, which taught that suffering is part of life, that's the first noble truth, that suffering has a cause, which is our own grasping and clinging and fixation, that also is true. Suffering is part of life. And the second noble truth, that suffering has a cause, that's also true, whether you're in the 8th century or whether you're in the 21st century. And that because grasping and clinging are the cause of suffering, that letting go of grasping and clinging is still the cause of liberation, even in this modern century. And that the path of doing no harm, practicing goodness, and taming the mind through meditation, those three things, do no harm, practice virtue, tame your mind, those three teachings that the Buddha gave for how to learn how to liberate ourselves from suffering, learn how to let go of our grasping and clinging, He said that how you learn to let go of grasping and clinging is through doing no harm, practicing virtue, and taming your mind. So I wanted to at least have everybody read it once, and then it's there, and we can respond to it and work with it and fight with it and learn what we can from it. And if you are interested in a modern-day interpretation of this chapter that is really, really good, I recommend Pema Chodron, the great American Buddhist teacher. Pema Chodron, who wrote Start Where You Are and Comfortable with Uncertainty and all of these kinds of books where she takes ancient subjects and makes them new. She actually wrote a book about the entire, about 9 of the 10 chapters of Shantideva, and the name of the book is No Time to Lose. No Time to Lose. In other words, there's no time to lose as we are attempting to liberate ourselves and others from this world of suffering. We can't just sit and relax and say, okay, I'll do it tomorrow. That we can actually wake up and be liberated in the moment by how we think. We can awake and liberate, be liberated in the moment by what we say, think, and do. And that we have a real powerful potential to be liberated in this moment always. And so her explanation of chapter 10 is eye-opening and smart and modern and funny. And so you can read her book to gain a sort of a new world insight into the meaning of chapter 10. Because Kemper Rinpoche's teaching, which I'll be sharing bits of in the coming days as I go through this topic, do look a little bit to the causes of consternation we might have. A lot of people tell me when they come to Buddhism, they say, well, I thought Buddhism was different than the church of my childhood. Some people say to me, they say, I'm very disturbed to see that the Buddha teaches about hell. So like, does the Buddha send people to hell? And it's like, no, it doesn't work like that. Hell is an experience. It's not necessarily a place. And we put ourselves there by our own thoughts, words, and actions. And we can gradually rescue ourselves from there through our thoughts, words, and actions. Even during the teaching that I'm basing these remarks on, Kempo Carter Rinpoche was asked in the question and answer. They said, okay, so Rinpoche, tell us, where's hell? And he smiled on the video, and he said, well, I can't honestly say I know where it is. And he says, I'm not actually sure it's a place. I'm not actually sure that there's a place somewhere that's labeled hell. It's more of an experience that people have where they are. And that experience comes from within us. And that is why Dharma and the teachings of meditation and generating love and compassion, both for ourselves and others, that's why they work to bring us out of that experience. And so, for example, that is, as we look at this text, some people feel a little dissonance when they talk about hell. But the fact of the matter is, remember that verse that I quoted from chapter 1, except for perfect bodhicitta, love and kindness and compassion, there is nothing powerful enough to withstand the force of evil. Well, our own loving heart can help us overcome everything. And I think that that's why in chapter 10, Shantideva imagines 3 bodhisattvas, great beings appearing in hell. I think that's why he sees this. This is sort of his, it's really interesting. The ending chapter on a lot of books tends to be, shall we say, apocalyptic and symbolic, you know, of like the fight of good and evil and things like that. And so isn't it interesting that our discouragement about suffering could be symbolized by hell and all of its described sufferings? And then goodness, which liberates us, can be symbolized by these 3 great bodhisattvas. Anyway, so we'll be delving more into that as time goes along. But before I pause here to take questions, because we'll have discussion now, but before I do that, I'm going to encourage everybody this week to look at your minds throughout the week and see where you are creating heaven and happiness for yourself and others, and where you're creating the opposite. And see if you can catch it, see if you can spot it. And then when you experience the heavenly ideal, which is happiness, when you experience that, make an aspiration. Don't just say, I'm happy, yay. Say, may all beings be happy just like this. Expand it. And that expands it out of the small orbit of our world and our people and our life and our this and our that. So that's when I talk about the gentle power of love. When we're happy, we don't have to abandon being happy. We can expand it by saying, may all beings have happiness just like this. When somebody puts a good meal in front of you, you think, may all beings have nourishing food just like this. When someone gives you a gift, then you feel joy that somebody cares enough for you to give you a gift. Say, may all beings have happiness and gifts like this. May they encourage one another always. And then on the opposite side, when you're feeling low or things are not going your way, you can say, may this and all of the nightmares of all beings be dispelled. Have you ever had a day like that where just like one bad thing happens after another? And at one point you're like thinking, darn, this is just like a bad dream. This day is just like a bad dream. Well, then you can think when misfortune happens, you can think, may the sort of nightmares of all beings be dispelled. May I be free of them, may all be free of them. And that's a way to try to open up a situation. And if you could also just make a prayer for the world this week, just say, may all, and just even if you want to just read the parts of this, you can look it up online. I'll have the link. I'll put the link up online, and I'll try to find a way to put the text up online. And you can start making some of those aspirations this week. And then next week, I'll be absent next week, and we'll be receiving teachings next week. I believe are we on interconnected now? Or are we on, Eric? Do you happen to know? Are you teaching? We're starting. Oh, this is really good. These two are coming together. The 17th Karmapa, who is I would call him a young environmentalist. He's like 31, 32, something like that. And he is deeply involved with the environment. He gave a series of teachings, and they made a book out of them about how we can impact our environment, both the environment that we're in on the earth and the environment that we're in inside our own heads and our environment of our relationships. So these three types of environments: our outer environment of the world, the inner environment of our thoughts, and then the intermediate environment of our relationships and how to navigate them in the modern world. So we're going to start that next Sunday. And then depending on my own travel schedule, I may be back the last weekend of the month. I'm scheduled to be back, but I may have a problem with my travel. So I'm looking into trying to fix that now. If I can be here on the 27th, I think I'll be here. It's that weekend. I'll do my best to be here. And then, so when we start next time, we'll talk a little bit about visions of heaven and visions of hell. And then the week after that, we'll talk about love and compassion and how they dispel our own inner negativity. And I think that will hopefully, complete the topic. We probably won't be reading this out loud again, but we might do it at the end as a way to kind of tie it all together. But I appreciate y'all being here and reading it with us today. So the question mic is now live. Thank you, Joseph. And if anybody wants to open a discussion either about what we read today or about the idea that bodhicitta can actually stand against evil, which I think is interesting, just to ask questions. You can get in line. My request is that you ask one question at a time so that everybody gets a chance. So anybody have questions, thoughts? Even if you want to make a comment, you can go up to the mic. And you can get in line if you prefer. There's chairs back there if you like.
A question about the dedication mm-hmm. prayer on the seventh stanzas has, may the regions of hell become places of joy. Mm-hmm. What are the regions of hell?
Yeah, they actually, what's interesting is that the Buddhist teaching of hell is that there are many types of suffering. And they are symbolized in iconography. Have you ever seen pictures from, like, Dante's Divine Comedy, where they talk about the levels of hell in Western?
I've seen that wheel thing with the rooster and stuff in it.
Yeah.
You know, where it has the six realms.
Yeah. And there is a hell realm depicted in the six realms Wheel of Life drawings. That's right. But regions are only figurative. You see what I'm saying? That, like, if you remember Dante's Divine Comedy, he has the Western Christian idea of hell, but it's all, like, divided into different places, and in each place you undergo a different kind of suffering. Like, and then here they talk about all of them: crushing, and razor sharp leaves on trees, and lava, and acid, and all of these things that we find physically repugnant and frightening. And so that's what they mean by regions of hell. And that's what they mean by regions of hell. Really, it talks about places, but it's more the type of suffering. Does that make sense?
All right. Makes sense. So I'll have another question about the 11th
stanza. Yeah, okay, yeah. And then you can get back in line, and then we'll see. Okay, yeah. Hello.
Thank you, Lama Kathy.
Yeah, thank you.
But the one thing that kind of... I guess, encourage me about the chapter 10 is when it talks about different beings who are suffering becoming well. So when I hear about, like, someone who have a mental problem or who are, like, totally physically unable to move, I could kind of imagine them able to get up and walk around or become healthy. And so it kind of gives me imagine that there could be much better things that could happen. So.
Right. I appreciate that. And I think that that's kind of the key of the next two Dharma talks, because the next two Dharma talks talk about both how our mind can create the suffering, and that but our mind can also create the opposite, which is a feeling of well-being. Our mind has the potential to create both well-being and suffering, and that because it is the same mind that creates suffering and well-being, that we have that potential in that moment to change from one to the other. I believe last week I may have used as kind of a comic or a humorous example the example of a telephone call. If you're arguing with someone and your phone rings, and it's the person on the phone is somebody you care for, you will actually in an instant change from being an angry arguer to a loving, you know, son, you know, or sister or brother, you know. You'll turn into a loving person just like that. And just as fast as that happens, that pivot can occur within our own mind at any moment. And I think the potential of that, the potential that that shows, is what the next two Dharma talks are going to be about. So thank you. If anybody else has a question, please get in line. So, yes, go ahead.
I was saying about the 11th stanza. Mm-hmm. Why are the henchmen of Yama, the unbearable buzzards and vultures, afraid? Mm-hmm. Who are the henchmen of Yama? Who is Yama? And why would they be afraid?
Right. I think if we think about what's happening here, what is this stanza illustrating? If we think about the bigger theme of that part of the chapter, the bigger theme is that he's creating a scene in which Padmapani or Chenrezig, Manjugosha, Manjushri, and Vajrapani appear in hell, And it this is and their appearance in hell is what strikes fear into the illusory henchmen of hell who are doling out the punishment in hell. You see, when we have the feeling of being in hell, we also have the feeling that others are contributing to or worsening our own suffering. Let's just think about being a human being who has the idea that they're in hell right now in this world. Let's just think about that for a second. When like, if I'm in an extremely bad mood and I'm really angry and a person comes up and says good morning to me, I'm going to feel like they're attacking me even though they're saying good morning. Does that make sense? Because I'm in such a bad mood. And so what they're saying is that these bodhisattvas symbolize our ability to let go and completely and to be completely purified.
Okay, so that's not literal then?
That's correct. That's correct. As you can see, that line begins with a quotation mark, right? And it ends with a quotation mark. You know, not the whole verse, but you see it starts with a quotation mark. Why are the henchmen of Yama, right? The buzzards and so forth. Here's the deal. It's with a quote mark. And so what this means is that it is as though a bystander in hell is remarking on the appearance of the three bodhisattvas. Because hell is supposed to be uninterrupted suffering. And so they're basically saying, wow, why is our suffering being interrupted? Like, we're okay with that. But, I mean, they're like, wow. And they're just, like, astonished that these three beings are appearing and all the bad guys are running away. And so this is the is a symbolic of the impact of being near the Dharma and being near holy people who love you and care for you. You see what I'm saying?
All right.
Because when you're with people who love you and care for you, it's like your suffering is dispelled. And so that's why it's stated like that. Okay? Yeah. There's another questioner, so if you want to get in line, we'll just...
Something more of a comment, I suppose. But,
sure.
We've kind of been talking about, like, literal versus figurative interpretation
sure.
of some of these things.
And, yeah.
We were just talking about the bodhisattvas appearing in the hell realms, and that really spoke to me in regards to a symbolic interpretation in which, even in the midst mm-hmm. of terrible anger, it's possible, perhaps unlikely, but possible that experiences of compassion, symbolized by Chenrezig, mm-hmm. or of vastness and insight, that is Manjugosha, or the feeling that this is possible, you can handle this, being mm-hmm. Vajrapani, you know, the mm-hmm. ability. And that even in the depths, these things can arise and do arise. Mm-hmm. And that's why we're able to turn toward the Dharma in the way we have.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I just wanted to sort of present that, perhaps let you expound on it, but I mm-hmm. thought it was
mm-hmm.
beautiful, you know, mm-hmm. this apocalyptic, as you described it, imagery, but also really I was able to connect to it in a very tangible way.
I really appreciate you sharing that idea. Thank you for that, because I do actually feel that that is the key piece, because many of us have experienced our own version of hell over the years, no matter what our age is. We've experienced something that feels like it at least once. And in the midst of that feeling, sometimes a person will come to us who we first think is an enemy because we're in such a bad way, but they'll say something, or they'll give us something, or they'll touch us in some way, you know, intellectually or whatever, and that we will see that there is a different possibility, and that that is like the appearance of these bodhisattvas in hell. And that moment of change is kind of the moment that I'm talking about. And knowing that that moment is possible is can bring hope. Because we've all been in this negative state and had something happen that for a moment turned us away from it. And that in a way, this apocalyptic vision that is then turned thematically into this beautiful appearance shows us how bodhicitta can conquer evil just in that moment. It shows us how it's possible. Maybe it doesn't take it apart and diagram that sentence, but it shows us how. And that's going to be the sort of the stuff, shall we say, the tofu instead of the meat. It's going to be the protein of the next couple of Dharma talks will be on that. So I really appreciate you sharing that. I couldn't said it better, so it's like, thank you. Yes, hi.
Hi. So just this week I've been reading Empire of Illusion by Chris Hedges, mm-hmm. and he's a New York Times journalist who also has a master's degree in divinity from Harvard, and he decided his ministry would be to give voice to the voiceless, so he was a journalist during all the School of the Americas things during the Reagan years in Central America and the war in Iraq and bought the genocide in Bosnia. So he spent 20 years seeing like literal living hells. Mm-hmm. So how does he, and then in this book he wrote, which Empire of Illusion, he wrote it during Obama era, but he described America as already being just like we're seeing with Trump, like the forces of fascism and the corporations taking over everything. And he's very apocalyptic. So how does he keep going? So at the very, very near the very end of this book, he quotes a Russian author whose name I can't remember because I didn't know I'd have to be telling you people this. But this author, his name starts with a V, if you get that book. Don't try to get it out of the library. I have it at my house.
Yeah. Quite all right.
But he said that the history of the of humankind is not a battle of good fighting against the forces of evil. It's the forces of evil trying to crush out the small kernel of kindness at the heart of every human. And that if goodness will always win no matter how powerless and stupid and ineffective our love is, they're never able to destroy it. And that if they haven't one, if evil hasn't triumphed in all this time in human history, it never will. Mm-hmm. And so I read that this week, and like I was carrying this book around with me all week, but not today. So then the words of Shanti Davis is that you're saying here, Kathy, is the same thing.
Wow. I really appreciate you sharing that, because that sort of potent image that what the evil doers do is try to, you said, crush the small kernel of kindness that naturally arises in people. That's amazing. Yeah. And that's exactly that small light is what brings about the overthrowing of evil.
And that's one reason why Buddhism always appealed to me, because a lot of the Christian and Jewish idea was good against evil, and I never mm-hmm. saw it that way. Mm-hmm. So just seeing it as goodness enduring is more helpful to me.
Mm-hmm. Right. Thank you very much. Oh, this is great. Okay, yeah, we've got time. I gave extra time today for conversation, so we're good. Yeah.
It's just kind of a general question, but...
Sure.
I don't know if this is true, but I'm kind of looking for your input as far as the good-evil balance.
Mm-hmm.
Is that always there? And if so, does evil always have to be there in order for good to be there and mm-hmm. love? Do you see what mm-hmm. I'm kind of...
I think I see what your question is. I wonder if maybe let me state something back to you and see if this resonates a little bit as to being what you're thinking. In some belief systems, in some world belief systems, good is thought to be a force, and evil is said to be a force, and that each of them have leaders and armies, and that sets up this type of fight, as we just were discussing, between the forces of good and the forces of evil. And what does the Buddhist belief system think about that? Am I getting close to, is that close to your question or?
Yeah. I see where you're going. I guess like from like a energy doesn't go away. So negative energy and positive energy has to be there. So in order for positive energy, does negative energy have to be there? And are they symbiotic?
Well, here's the thing. This is where I think the Buddhist belief system is kind of interesting, because the Buddhist belief system does not posit that there was an supreme intelligence that created good and then created evil. So because the Buddhists don't posit that somebody created it, the Buddha was not a person who is a god. He denied being a god. What he did say that he was an observer, a wise observer of the world. He observed, like Newton observed gravity. I mean, you know, right? The Buddha observed the minds of people and how the minds of people gave rise to positive emotions and how the minds of people gave rise to negative emotions. So like a dispassionate scientific observer, he observed that beings who gave rise to positive thoughts and virtuous feelings were happy, and those who gave rise to negative thoughts and actions were always suffering and involved in some kind of terrible struggle. He did not posit that there was a larger scheme in the universe in which there was a faction of goodness and a faction of evil, or a faction of positiveness and faction of negativeness. It was actually more scientific. I'm not sure if I'm... Am I getting close, guys?
I see where you're going. I appreciate that. It's just changing how I'm thinking about it as an energy force, as opposed to what you're saying is just we've created it in our heads, kind of.
Sort of, yeah. It's very interesting. It's that he observed the universe as being like this, and so he said, if you want happiness, do good. If you want to stop suffering, then stop doing negative things. He really just brought it down to the individual level. It, in a way, he said that each of us is the creator of our own experience. And in a way, we are each the creator of our own world system that we live in. And so you see what I'm saying? It's so our world system and our worldview will reflect our inner conflicts. And is the world really like that on the outside, or is that just our experience of it? I don't know. If anybody has something they'd like to add to that, Eric, if you wouldn't mind going to the microphone and adding to that, because I think, do you see where we're, are we getting closer?
Yeah.
I'm just talking about like,
yeah,
it's
great. I appreciate that.
Okay, so it's kind of like a worldview. It's like, Eric, give it a shot.
Okay, I'll give it a shot.
I had a feeling there was like one more opinion in the audience I wanted.
It seems to me that our mental habit is to try to get what we want and try to avoid what we don't want.
Okay.
And it's a kind of selfish way of being. Selfish meaning that we're grasping at a self. We don't have any objective understanding of that. So what somebody thinks of as evil, somebody else might think of as good.
Mm-hmm. Ah.
And what somebody thinks of as good, somebody else might think of as evil.
Uh-huh.
So as we create our self, our identity, so to speak, with its likes and dislikes, we kind of create the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so these forces of good and evil actually are part of just our preferences.
Mm-hmm.
What Shantideva seems to be trying to get us to do,
mm-hmm,
is to stop running away from what we don't like and to stop chasing after what we think we absolutely have to have,
mm-hmm,
and to rest, because in that rest, in that meditation,
mm-hmm,
we can find that kernel of kindness that Winnie was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And when we rest in that, mm-hmm, we wake up. So that's what I would say. This idea of good and evil is just our idea based on our preferences. So it's relative world and ultimate world,
right,
to put it in Thai Situ world.
Right, purpose, words. Yeah. So the whole idea that there has to be some sort of scientifically, you know, there's the, what was it, mass and energy and you know, the reservation of energy. And I don't understand all that, okay? But so the world may be scientifically laid out like that, but the Buddha did not posit that there were specific forces that needed to be in some kind of cosmic balance. Here's one. This is what I was thinking when Eric was talking. Okay, now here's the thing. You can actually observe this in your own mind. You'll have a thought, and then the thought ends. Before the next thought begins, there's space. And it's really, that's the interesting place. Okay, because that's really what, that's all dualism is, right? Whether it's positive and negative or good and evil. It's that moment when that sort of moment when thought and you know, this thought and the space between thought when they alternate, you know, so it's kind of like that. That's where the change gets made, and that's really the main duality that that is talked about in books like Bokha Rinpoche's book, The Profound Wisdom of the Heart Sutra, where he talks about form and emptiness being the same. In other words, things are unestablished. You can't say that something is always, things don't create themselves. They, you know, you see what I'm saying? This table didn't create itself, and so forth. And so even though things are unestablished, that doesn't mean they're nothing. You see, even though the mind is not a thing, it's not made of molecules, right? It's not a thing. It's also not nothing because it knows and it experiences. And so to me, that's the key duality to look at. All right, thanks for that. Thank you, Eric.
Okay. I was just thinking in terms of, you know, when I worked with children and stuff, but I still think it applies. It's universal whether you're old, you're young, or educated or not. If you thought of it in the terms of fire, it was real easy for kids to do, like, as you know, is it good or is it bad? Or in Zen they said, no praise, no blame. And is fire good or bad? And then we went to, like, well, if the fire cooks my dinner and the fire keeps me warm, I think it's good. If the fire burns the house down and the fire destroys the forest, then we bad. And it's like, no, it's just fire. It's only in my mind and the way I interpret it or want to apply an interpretation of good and bad, of evil and not. But the reality is it is what it is. But in related to this whole thing, because I do, for me, it's extremely confusing and melodramatic.
Yes, I know. It is a melodramatic piece, yes.
And, well, and like so many things in the early readings of, you know, of it can't be just a dozen lotus blossoms, billions upon billions of lotus blossoms descending from...
I get it.
But the point is my understanding that the Buddha always, and part of why I'm attracted to this, is believe nothing because I said it. Believe it
right.
Because you're on your own journey. Yeah. And number one, that this isn't even the Buddha, it's Shantideva,
yeah.
And so who knows how they elaborate. But go to the point of number 21... about no more illness, and may every disease in the world never occur again, completely goes against the whole basic thing of samsara, of the reality is there is suffering, there is death,
right,
and accepting them and moving beyond. Mm-hmm. So the final thing is, has anybody even in this day and age ever added what you generously gave in a written text? An interpretation of, we're not talking about a kind of hell with fire and burning. We're not talking about 100 million lotus blocks. Really, none of this is really to be taken as it's written.
Mm-hmm.
And without those footnotes, I don't know how anybody really can get through it.
I actually do think that Pema, I thank you for that, and I do think that Pema Chodron gets as close as anybody does to doing that. So I'd say that would be the best. But now I'm gonna like go against that.
Uh-huh.
Now that I've said yes, now I'm gonna say no. Mm-hmm. Because the Buddha taught on both levels, the relative level and the ultimate level. relatively, yeah, there's a hell, kind of, but not. But ultimately, there isn't one. But you better act as though there is one, or your karma is really going to stink, and you'll never get enlightened. You see what I'm saying? So we have all, so the wish for all suffering, including illness, to end is basically saying, may someday samsara come to an end. That's really what is meant by that. And the million lotus blossoms, may all beings awaken to their own nature. And you see what I'm saying? And so, yeah, even Kempo Rinpoche himself said that he could not point to a place and say that's hell. He says it is your experience. And so the million lotus blossoms are your experience. The burning floor, that's your experience, which, by the way, is talked about in one of the earlier chapters where Shantideva says, who made these crushing iron mountains, and who made this burning floor? He said, we did. We made it through our own negative afflictions that we fed.
See, I just see that as all part of the danger of ever doing any readings from any of the traditions in a literal
Well, that's, and I get it.
That's
I get
very
it.
Dangerous.
Well, and I, literal. Yeah, because you're absolutely right, because just as human beings can react with prejudice to anything, they can react, they can read things like that and then react in prejudice against people, or they can react in prejudice against themselves. And so we have to be careful that we imbue everything with a sense of love. You see what I'm saying? So that we have that. So we have that part of it. So we have to use the instructive part of it, which is don't do evil.
Right.
Don't be evil, right? And then the second is to do good. And so we have to just imbue that in everything, including how we read these texts. For the people for whom this is frightening, we have to do everything we can to pour cool rain upon them. For the people who are not scared enough, we actually need to turn that fire up a little bit. You see what I'm saying?
Okay.
Yeah, I know. You've met heedless people who need to be yanked out of traffic, right? Uh-huh. That's what I mean by fire. You actually need to yank them out of traffic so they don't step into it. And you may not say, dear, don't step into traffic, because they're already halfway out of the street. You have to yank them back. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm talking about. Okay. I'm not talking about being purposefully mean to people to teach them a lesson or whatever kind of silly thing we may have in our mind. I'm saying that sometimes we have to rescue people, and it's not going to hurt. I mean, it's not going to feel good. Sometimes you need to give somebody, for example, people who are addicted to alcohol and drugs, sometimes you have to give them the hard truth. And it looks bad, but it's actually beneficial. So it's kind of like that. So, yeah.
I was just reading the Diamond Sutra and the Heart Sutra with Thich Nhat Hanh's interpretations. Mm-hmm. And so what he was talking a lot about was interbeing. And so we're made of the same stuff. You know, we might call people evil. You know, there are no people. We're all substance from, you know, plants and mm-hmm. rain and soil and our history and our genes, and so are they, and we depend on each other, mm-hmm. and we are with them too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like in all kinds of ways. So I mean, I think in that way there isn't good and evil, because we're made by each other, basically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I wish I understood things to that extent. I wish that was my experience of the world. I think that we definitely influence each other, which I think is really amazing. And that's how I would interpret the phrase interbeing. And I think that that is why society as a whole has an obligation to, as was mentioned in the earlier question, to protect the most vulnerable of its populations. Every society has an obligation to protect them from danger, and they also, and to keep them encouraged, and not to discourage them by things that showing them and doing things to them that discourage them. I think that's really, in the end, what that previous question in a way was all about, was always encouraging people, never discouraging them from in a way that would be harmful to them. And I think that because human beings do, in the interplay between human beings is so powerful. Science is even studying how effective our minds can be outside our bodies. So that gives new reasons for us not to be evil to ourselves or to other people, not even to have negative thoughts toward other people, because it changes our nonverbal communication and so forth. So I really appreciate you talking about that intimate interbeing idea, and that we actually do have the potential to liberate and benefit each other. So,
Thank you. I think it's also like it came from somewhere. If someone is acting badly or cruelly, it came from their life experience and their genes and that sort of thing. So instead of putting a label on it, it's like we're all influenced by our pasts and that sort of thing. So, I mean, I think it's a labeling issue, too.
Yeah, and I really appreciate you adding that. And I think that that's something that helps us relax our own labels against ourselves and against others. So thank you. Wow. Who knew that reading chapter 10 would give, well, Shantideva, you know, Shantideva basically took the sutras and distilled them. And this was his distillation of the sutras' teachings on these things. So I think he saved us some trouble, because the sutras are really long. And so hearing his estimation in chapter 10 is much shorter. So I'm so glad we gave ourselves that gift. So thank you for your patience and being with us today as we went through chapter 10. And then the next two Dharma talks will be on how we create suffering and also how we create goodness. So those will be and then the power of love to help us create goodness. So that's going to be the next two talks. I finally figured out the organization. This happens. Before we close, I want to remind everyone that we are going to be putting on a mindfulness event, Mindfulness All Over Town, Saturday the 1st of June at 10 local libraries. We still have posters here if people are interested in putting up posters at your favorite beverage store or your favorite bookstore or your favorite coffee shop. This would be awesome, and all I ask is that you come up after, grab a poster, and write down where you're putting it. Additionally, I want to apologize to everyone who signed up last week to greet. I lost the note. I folded it up, put it in my pocket, and lost it. I promise not to do that this week. So if you are interested in serving as a greeter, which is a two-hour commitment on that Saturday to help bring people into the classes at the libraries, I have a sign-up sheet on the other side. So I'll be sitting here for a little while the shrine's being closed, and I can answer additional questions. Let's close today by sitting quietly and making a mental dedication of the goodness from this session. We dedicate the goodness from this session to all suffering beings. May all beings everywhere be free from suffering, come to happiness, and then to Buddhahood. And coming to Buddhahood, may they emanate in all directions and benefit sentient beings endlessly. We mentally dedicate this goodness with this thought in mind. Okay, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.